Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The John Birch Society was an ultra-right-wing political movement that feasted on conspiracy theories. It was founded in 1958 by businessman Robert Welch, who claimed, among other things, that President Eisenhower, a staunch Republican, was a dedicated agent of the communist conspiracy, that black Southerners' push for civil rights was fomented entirely by the communists. Welch even blamed communists for putting fluoride in public water supplies with the passion of today's anti-vaxxers. And like Donald Trump and his devoted base, Birchers refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of their political opposition. At its peak, the John Birch Society had 100,000 members, and it represented an opportunity and a challenge for Republican elites, not unlike the challenge they face today. While some denounced the Birchers as dangerous, paranoid extremists, others feared losing their political support. Among them, Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater. During his run for the presidency, he criticized Robert Welch, but embraced his followers. He said they're good people. They believe in the Constitution, in God, in freedom. And when he accepted the Republican presidential nomination in 1964, Goldwater delivered this memorable line.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Goldwater lost the 64 presidential election in a landslide to Democrat Lyndon Johnson, and the influence of the John Birch Society eventually faded, but its ghosts remained. In fact, in 2016, another far-right populist Republican with the support of conservative conspiracists won the presidency. So how has the spirit of the John Birch Society lived on, and what does the history of the John Birch Society teach us about far-right populism in America today? This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. And joining us now is Edward Miller. He's associate teaching professor at Northeastern University, and he's the author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. And Ted Miller, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much.
Sure. Great book, great subject. I'm really excited to be talking to you about it. Also with us is Jack Beatty. He's On Point News Analyst. Jack, always great to have you. Welcome.
Hello, Anthony. Hello, Ted.
So, hello. Ted, let's start with Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society. Tell us about him. Who was he?
Robert Welch was born in North Carolina. He was the son of a farmer. He had a long history of a family of farmers. And he came to Boston to study Harvard Law, leaving Harvard Law School because of the liberal policies of Felix Frankfurter. And then he went into the candy business and was a very successful candy manufacturer, creating such childhood favorites as the Sugar Daddies, the Junior Mints. But he had aspirations beyond the candy business. He wanted to go into politics himself. He would run for lieutenant governor in 1950. He had aspirations to beat John F. Kennedy in 1958. Lofty aspirations nonetheless. And despite failing in his inaugural bid for lieutenant governor for the he did very respectively. He came in second to the former Republican state treasurer in the primary. He decided that he needed to pursue an educational organization. In 1958, he founded the John Birch Society, which was a conspiratorial organization. He became renowned and notorious for his claim that President Eisenhower was a communist. This led to a response from his nemesis on the respectable right, William F. Buckley, who tried to drive him out of the movement. He was unsuccessful, I argue, but Welch stayed in there. Mm-hmm. He changed his tactics.
Well, let's talk about that. Before we get there, I want to hear a little bit of Welch's voice. So here's John Birch Society founder Robert Welch in 1974 talking about some of the priorities of the John Birch Society.
Our immediate and most urgent anxiety, of course, is the threat of the communist conspiracy. And well, it should be. For both internationally and within the United States, the communists are much further advanced and more deeply entrenched than is realized by even most of the serious students of the danger among the anti-communists.
So Robert Welch there speaking in 1974, talking about communist conspiracies, which he said included the president, President Eisenhower. Tell me, Ted, who the John Birch Society appealed to. What kind of Americans with what kind of grievances were drawn to this movement?
That's a wonderful question. The John Birch Society appealed primarily to those people who were disappointed with the Eisenhower presidency. They thought that Eisenhower was going to roll back the New Deal. They thought he was going to liberate Eastern Europe. So many Midwestern conservatives who had backed Robert Taft in 1952 and believed that the 1952 Republican nomination was stolen by Robert Taft from it was stolen by Eisenhower from Robert Taft, came to support a more far-right brand of conservatism, which the John Birch Society embodied. They were Midwestern industrialists. They were the men of Main Street, not Wall Street, which Eisenhower represented. They were the everyday men and women who were concerned about where their country was heading in the 1950s, and despite the fact that Eisenhower is seen as a grandfatherly figure of modern conservatism, they rejected that notion and came to the conclusion that Eisenhower had nefarious aims.
Right. And I gather we're talking about a population, at least among his supporters, a population of people who are sort of upset about some of the ways America was changing. For instance, movements like integration, school desegregation, rise of the welfare state, these kinds of issues were troubling to them, right?
Eisenhower came to the conclusion that if any party comes out against Social Security, that's the end of that political party.
Right.
So Eisenhower is going to back an expanded Social Security program. Welch rejected that. He wanted a rollback of all the New Deal programs, which provided a social net. And he was very disappointed with Eisenhower, and especially Eisenhower's steal, his alleged steal, which is preposterous, of the 1952 Republican nomination.
Imagine that, someone claiming that an election was stolen. Where have we heard that before?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Jack Beatty, I know you've read Ted Miller's book deeply. I know you've got some questions you'd like to ask him. What's on top of your mind as we talk about the birth of the John Birch Society and the way its ghosts linger today?
Well, one question or comment is a comment that Professor Miller uses from a conservative intellectual who said, Ike isn't a communist, he's a golfer.
That's a great line.
Right, yeah. But you know, this book, I think, represents something important. It represents the search for a usable past. Frederick Jackson Turner, the great progressive historian, he of the frontier hypothesis, wrote, "Each age writes the history of the past anew. with reference to the conditions uppermost in its own time. Well, the condition uppermost in our own time is Trumpism. How did we get to this sort of mass irrationality, this force based now on a big lie? How could this happen in America? And we at Princeton, Sean Wilentz, a historian, has said Trump is incomparable. Nothing sui generis. Nothing can be compared. But I think Professor Miller is right. We see the seeds of Trumpism all through the story of Robert Welch and the John Birch Society, the seeds of paranoia, of racism. And the big difference is scale. At its most, maybe 40,000 members of the John Birch Society. There are millions of Americans now who swallow the Trump lie, and this has brought us, this repudiation of truth has brought us to the point where the warning of Tim Schneider in on tyranny is something to ponder. He writes, post-truth is pre-fascism. How did we get to pre-fascism in America today? And I think this book helps to explain the precursor.
Ted Miller, in the minute we have or so before the break, do you want to expand on what Jack was talking about there, the sort of seeds of Trumpism being sowed essentially by the John Birch Society?
I can. The interesting thing is that Robert Welch never went away. Now, the common narrative is that William F. Buckley excised him from the movement, that he saw a problem. William Rusher refers to the idea that the conservative movement could become hardened and more of a fascist movement. Buckley comes to the conclusion that the conspiratorial aspects of conservatism have to be removed. That part has to be abandoned. Welch, after Buckley's attack, comes to realize that he has to do something else.
So I'm going to stop you there, and that's where we're going to pick up right after the break, because we've got to take this break. You can hear the music coming up. We're talking about the origins of the right-wing conspiracy theories, from the John Birch Society to Trumpism, with Edward Miller, author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Today we're talking about the origins of right-wing conspiracy theories, from the John Birch Society to Trumpism. We're joined by Ted Miller. He's professor at Northeastern University and the author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. Also with us, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And Ted Miller, before the break, we were talking about William F. Buckley, leader of conservative thought, publisher of the National Review. At one point, he's a supporter of Welch and the John Birch Society, but he turns against him. What was sort of the breaking point for Buckley?
Well, the breaking point was the conspiratorial conclusion that Eisenhower was a communist, and the conspiratorial conclusion that a large portion of the American government was controlled by the Kremlin. Buckley saw the threat as being external, as did President Kennedy, whereas Welch concluded that the threat was internal, that the communists were here, that the communists were fighting to stop the John Birch Society. He was fearing for his life and expressed some of the paranoia that becomes associated with the John Birch Society brand. And Welch is, his numbers begin to plummet after the loss in 1964, despite the fact that a number of
The loss of Barry Goldwater.
Barry Goldwater. Right. I mean, Barry Goldwater needed that support in 1964 to get five southern states. But Welch changes his tactic. And this is very, very important. And it's something that historians have missed thus far, because Welch came to the conclusion that his numbers as far as becoming a member of the John Birch Society, that was not going to work. So he began to establish these ad hoc committees that consisted not necessarily of John Birchers, but consisted of members who were sympathetic to the aims of these ad hoc committees. These ad hoc committees are going to represent the social and libertarian beginnings of the Reagan Revolution. For instance, Welch was an early proponent of pro-life campaigns. His right-hand man, John McManus, was a big supporter of the pro-life movement well before evangelicals had. McManus was a Catholic, as were many Birchers. McManus began to come to the conclusion very early as 1970, that abortion was murder, he said, he wrote. And after the 1968 election, the running of George Wallace in 1968, and the election of James Buckley to the United States Senate, Richard Nixon saw this. James Buckley was William F. Buckley's brother, and James Buckley ran as a pro-life candidate. Nixon saw that race and said, you know what? The Republicans can win with a pro-life position. And Nixon did the same.
I see.
And pursued this. And the Republican Party did the same. Now, as early as 1969, the John Birch Society is very pro-life, consisting of many Catholics. But it's not just the social issues. It's the issues such as tax relief. Welch was not
No, I want to ask you about this because there are sort of two levels that seem to function on and that sort of explain Welch's power here. And this is a question about his grassroots followers and who benefited from these political goals. And I'm thinking here, again, of parallels to Trump in this way. You know, Trump has been able to excite and activate a political base that doesn't necessarily benefit from the actual policies of Trump. Another way to put it, Republican elites have put up with Trump's excesses, including his anti-democratic authoritarianism, his conspiracies, as long as they get their conservative judges, lower taxes, rollback of regulations. Was there a similar dynamic at work around Welch and the John Birch Society, where there was this base that supported him and sort of Republican political interest that existed at a higher level, if you will?
I think that's a fair analysis, that there is a more establishment, Nixonian establishment at that particular time, but there was this a very strong, growing Catholic as well as Protestant base that was growing in the 1970s. And that's when Welch began to get the support of a lot of those grassroots individuals, the folks who went into the bait shop and read his American Opinion magazine, the folks who went to the grocery store and received his bulletin, the folks who went to the barber shop and were captivated by that book that was published by Western Union Press, the John Birch Society Press.
Sure.
So they began to imbibe those books. Hmm. And it started a movement, I think, that ultimately led to Reagan's Morning in America. Not exclusively, but it was a major part of it. It's not just cultural issues.
But how did Ronald Reagan manage the sort of conspiratorial nature of the Birchers? I mean, he didn't fully embrace that, did he?
He didn't fully embrace it. In fact, that Welch argued that Reagan was not a conservative because of his support of a 1967 abortion law. But as Reagan left, after he left the California governor's mansion, Reagan had a radio show. He also had a newsletter where he began to ape some of the same concepts of the John Birch Society. He would walk into meetings with his aides and complain about the gold standard. He argued a conspiratorial notion that President Ford had faked his own assassination attempts. And Reagan was running against Ford in 1976.
Right.
So Reagan was not a Bircher, but he was feeling what was going on in California.
He imbibed some of the sort of energy of the Birchers.
He was imbibing some of the energy. He had a lot of support.
Yeah. Let me go to Jack Beatty. Jack, I know you've been listening along. Other parallels with sort of contemporary moments that we're living through right now that come to mind? Or what are you thinking about as you listen to Ted Miller talk about the John Birch Society?
Well, one thing, the John Birch Society, in a way, I don't think that Trumpism has been. Great satire was visited upon the John Birch Society, the Chad Mitchell Trio. Here's a lyric: "You cannot trust your neighbor or even next of kin. If mommy is a commie, you gotta turn her in." and then Bob Dylan famously in the talking John Birch Paranoid Blues, he says, "I was looking every which way for them gall down reds. I got up in the morning and looked under the bed." He was banned from the Ed Sullivan Show because he wanted to sing that song on the air. But the point is, it was ludicrous. There was a ludicrous element to it. And in Dr. Strangelove, the character Jack D. Ripper, who the colonel, the crazy colonel who sort of blows up the world, he says, "Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous commie plot we've ever had to face?" That's straight Birchism. But that was a satire on Birchism. In a strange way, Trump, who's ludicrous in every way, his orange, let's not even go into it. He's just he should be a figure of fun. He's been moralized. People have been condemning him. But this use of humor and to sort of puncture the aura of Trump, nothing like what the John Birch Society and Robert Welch endured.
Interesting. How did Welch respond to that? Did he bounce back from that, from being a butt of jokes of the kind that Jack was just talking about?
He did. I completely agree, Jack. The Kennedys tried ridicule to temper the popularity of the John Birch Society. Robert Kennedy called it nonsensical, the John Birch Society. John Kennedy, in a speech, said, to paraphrase, that it was not in the spirit of the 1960s. That derision, that ridicule, that mockery that has been attempted on Trump seemed to be as innocuous as far as the being ineffectual.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that potentially it worked for a time for Welch. I mean, it worked for a time to temper the popularity of Welch. But then, as he began to develop these committees that consisted of non-Birchers, but people who were interested in tax reform, were interested in opposing the ERA, were interested in opposing abortion, were interested in supporting gun control. That was another cultural issue. Were interested in rolling back what they saw as an expansion of democracy. They said, you know, it's a republic, not a democracy. Let's keep it that way. That was the slogan that they tried.
Sure. You mentioned Robert Kennedy, and he had special, when I say he, I'm talking about Robert Welch, had sort of special consideration for the Kennedys. I came across this quote: "Our menace is not the big red army from without, but the big pink enemy within. Our menace is the KKK, Kennedy, Kennedy, and Kennedy." So he had some special animus toward the Kennedys, clearly.
Oh, he clearly did. He had probably greater animus for Kennedy's rival, Richard Nixon, because he saw Richard Nixon as a phony. And in 1962, when Richard Nixon ran against Pat Brown...
For governor of California.
Of California. Nixon attacked Tom Schell, who was a Bircher, and ultimately Nixon won the nomination, but two other Birchers lost, Eck Heistand and John Rousselet. But his I don't want to say antipathy for John Kennedy, because it was perhaps an envy. Welch had tried to get into politics. Welch wanted to be in the Senate. He saw himself as a potential successor to Kennedy in the Senate, which was ridiculous. Welch had a veteran problem. He was not a veteran. JFK obviously had a veteran, didn't have a veteran problem, and was a hero in PT-109. And perhaps that was the cause of some of the... some of the tension.
Interesting. How do you see the influence of the John Birch Society and right-wing conservatism today? I mean, I'm thinking about the political impact of the GOP's attachment to fight abortion, gun control, et cetera. That seems like a pretty clear connection. But what about the conspiratorial aspect? Do you see any similarities between the political environment before the rise of the John Birch Society versus the rise of Trump, for example?
Well, even you know, 2 days ago, I think that the Governor DeSantis said something about the smuggling of some nefarious ideas into the schools. He was very, ambiguous about what he meant by that that statement. But I think he was talking about the idea that school children are being introduced with some. What he sees as strange ideas. One of the key intellectuals of the John Birch Society, E. Merrill Root, wrote a book, Collectivism on Our Campuses. He also wrote a book about collectivism in our high schools. And he was concerned about how these ideas were creeping into our schools, and they were infecting the minds of our children and then liberalizing them. Yeah. And
so it goes on.
And,
yeah.
And Welch, one of the first things he said was, join the PTA. Now, in my town where I live, Scituate, there was a significant PTA, a school board fight school committee fight. I think that is echoed throughout the country.
Really interesting. Jack, we were talking this morning, and I want you to sort of bring this up with Ted, the John Birch Society and the connection to race in America and sort of how profound that conversation is.
Yes, I found it so striking that Robert Welch was from North Carolina, northern part of North Carolina, near the Virginia border. His family were slaveholders. They were lived within, I think you say, 75 miles of Nat Turner's Rebellion, where, you know, white people were killed in their sleep by their slaves. And this paranoia, and I think what we see here is this milieu of fear. Mm-hmm. Every Southern slaveholder lived in total fear. The expression of it reached an apotheosis with Henry Clay's speech about the Compromise of 1850, where he said, you know, we're asleep in our beds, and we will go to sleep every night with the fear that the slave will descend on us with axe and knife. This form of paranoia, of racial paranoia, it comes up in other, isn't it telling that the flourishing period of the John Birch Society was the paranoia of the Cold War, the same idea, the Reds under the bed, we're the bed again, and the connections between it's almost as if race fear is the fantasy of the right wing. We have Tucker Carlson showing an image of black, quote, rioters and saying, when they come for you, that's right back with Henry Clay. We have Donald Trump saying to Carol Lenig of the Washington Post, saying his biggest regret, president, he didn't turn the army loose on the Black Lives Matter protesters. Mm. That paranoia is instinct with the right wing, the fear of race war, perhaps the guilty conscience about race. All of this has a genetic milieu in North Carolina.
All right, that's Jack Beatty, of course, and our guest this hour, Ted Miller. He's author of a new profile of Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society. More after this break. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Today we're talking about the origins of right-wing conspiracy theories, from the John Birch Society to Trumpism. We're joined by Edward Miller. He's professor at Northeastern University and the author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society and the Revolution of American Conservatism. We're also joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And Ted Miller, before we go back to you, I want to play a little bit of tape about conspiracy theories. They've become prevalent again today. Here's Tucker Carlson of Fox News suggesting that Democrats are involved in this idea of a replacement theory. They want to replace American voters. Here he is.
You've heard a lot about the great replacement theory recently. It's everywhere in the last 2 days, and we're still not sure exactly what it is. Here's what we do know for a fact. There is a strong political component to the Democratic Party's immigration policy. We're not guessing this. We know this.
So the great replacement theory, of course, the idea that newly arrived immigrants are replacing white Americans. Tucker Carlson didn't spell it out that way, but that's the theory. And Ted, before the break, Jack was talking about the important role of race that was part of the John Birch Society ideology and the way that continues to play out today. Tell us more about that aspect of the John Birch Society.
Well, I think it's a super issue to discuss further. And I agree with Jack that the Welch family and Welch himself felt beleaguered and beset and surrounded by the racial issues that were changing. He wrote, he was really a tragic figure in that he did not embrace what was going on in the 1950s as far as race. The changes that were going on, and as what President Kennedy said, the great change that is at hand. Because Welch grew up in an area of African Americans. He grew up in a North Carolina county, which was predominantly African American. It had a majority of African Americans, unlike Eisenhower, who grew up in an area that was homogeneously white. But I think that you can see how Welch treated the race issue early on as not the main issue in his billboards against Earl Warren. Earl Warren, of course, is the Chief Justice of the United States who passed Brown versus Board of Education, which after a long period of time would begin the process of ending segregation in this country. Welch put up signs that said, "Impeach Earl Warren." And these signs were ubiquitous throughout the United States. They were ironically all across Eisenhower's interstate highway system. Welch, as 1965 came along, and he sensed a backlash after Watts, begins to go.
The race riots in Los Angeles, essentially.
And also the race riots in Detroit. He came to see what was going on with the civil rights struggle as what was going on in the anti-colonial movements in Africa. Mm-hmm. And so he began to double down on race. And it was Alan Stang, one of his most prolific writers, who convinced Welch to really mount a strong campaign that the civil rights movement was controlled by the communists. And in 1965, the John Birch Society would publish Stang's book. It's very simple. The True Story of Civil Rights, which presented the civil rights as a communist struggle. Welch would also propose that the communists killed Martin Luther King, but it was he, because King would be more valuable to them as a martyr than a live human being.
Boy, Ted Miller, I want to ask you another question that sort of brings this history forward, and we're having this conversation with the backdrop of the January 6th hearings, the congressional investigation looking into the attack on the Capitol. Were there concerns back in the day of the John Birch Society when it was sort of in its full power? Were there concerns of political violence?
There were concerns, and Welch would, one of the tragic aspects of Welch is that he participates and continues to engage in many letters with segregationists and even people who are of a more violent persuasion. And so there was some consideration of potential violence against the John Birch Society would commit.
Where does the John Birch Society, what does it do today? Does it exist even?
It does exist today, and it's it has in recent years with the pandemic and the election of 2020 has been growing, and it has been it was basically relegated to the ash bin of history, according to historians. But in recent years, it has received somewhat of a rebirth.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. So I want to ask you about that, because here we are talking about the influence of the John Birch Society in 2022. So and you're talking about a rebirth. What about, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's not necessarily the society itself. It's the ideas
sure.
that the society itself is promoting. It's the it promoted. It's the idea that that the Second Amendment is to be taken away. And that wasn't something that the that the NRA supported initially. That was something that the John Birch Society supported. So I think it's more the ideological aspects that the John Birch Society continued. I in no way suggest that the John Birch Society in my book is making a significant comeback. It's the ideas that remained, and the John Birch Society was the provided some of the seedlings for this this growth.
Right, right. Well, what about sort of I'm interested in the sort of connection to Trump and Trumpism, and just for the sake of a hypothetical argument, let's assume that Trump just takes too many hits between now and 2024, doesn't run for president again, or doesn't win again. Does Trumpism sort of endure beyond Trump? I mean, is that one of the lessons here about the John Birch Society? Because it seemed to sort of have its moment and then it waned, but here we are sort of talking about the long influence that it's had for such a long time.
Well, one of the great lessons that I've learned in being an historian is that we the most important lesson is that we can't predict the future. So, but it seems that given the long history of populist conservative movements, that this does have a longer shelf life than we presumed, and it could become in the candidacy of DeSantis, who
governor of Florida, who might be running for president,
who just appointed a secretary of state who hasn't admitted that Biden was elected in a fair fashion. It's inevitable, I think, that we're going to see some aspects of this populism continue, whether it reaches the apogee that Trump was able to attain is a question that we all have to just
big question, Jack. That's a big question. How are you thinking about that, or what other questions do you have for Ted Miller about the ghosts of the John Birch Society as they exist today?
Well, one is in Donald Trump. Of course, we read in the New York Review that Roger Stone, no less, said that Fred Trump, man, who was arrested at a Ku Klux Klan rally in the 20s, that Fred Trump was a friend of Robert Welch and a contributor to the John Birch Society. So there's the passing the torch to Mr. Trump. But the issue you raise, Anthony, of, you know, will Trumpism have a future? You have to bet that it will. And I think JFK at Yale, in a very important speech that you quote, Ted, put his finger on why. He said, speaking to the graduation class, I think 1962 at Yale, he said, the great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and dishonest. And he urged the students to be on the side of reality against the spread of illusion. Well, the myth is what we call today the narrative, and that's what we heard with Tucker Carlson, the narrative of white replacement, the narrative of the wicked Black Lives Matter movement, myths that just proliferate as stories. And those are the things, those are the pernicious mental infections that I'm afraid Trumpism has given new life to, and almost assured a future in the Republican Party.
Ted Miller, your thoughts on that?
I agree. I'll finish with an anecdote. I was outside the Apple store very early the other day, and somebody asked me, do we live in a republic or a democracy? And I think I'll just leave it at that. I think that these ideas that Robert Welch proposed just continue on in everyday life and everyday conversation, and we're going to be with them for a long time.
You know, it's interesting, if I have this right, so at its height, the John Birch Society had about 100,000 followers. Is that about right?
It's smaller. It's an organization that he saw as almost a private company where he didn't have to disclose all the information.
Interesting. Huh?
But the Massachusetts records, as far that were filed with the Secretary of State, suggested that it never got beyond 24,000.
Oh, really? So small. Wow.
30,000, perhaps. Hmm. We don't know the numbers of those ad hoc committees, and I think that's really the key. If we could, I tried to pin down the numbers of the ad hoc committees, but it was just it was too difficult because you can't figure out how many people were participating. But given the success of the ad hoc committees, I can imagine it's a lot more.
Well, where I was going with that question, anyway, a relatively small number of people, but a big influence, and obviously a big influence if we're still talking about it all these years later. But it's worth noting that, of course, this was happening in the days long before social media. And I'm just wondering if you've thought about that, if John Birch sort of had the power of Twitter at his fingertips like Donald Trump has had, you know, what kind of power would he have had?
Oh, I think that if it was wielded in a way that was effectual, there would have been a significant amount of success. But there was a statement by Clifford White, who was a very important figure in the Goldwater movement, that just a few people can take over a precinct. A few people more can take over a county. A few people more can take over a state. And you need just a small number of zealots to drive things. Even Mao Zedong said that two people can take over a village as far as influencing things.
Wow.
So it's not the numbers. It's really just the ideas and the persistence and the passion and the commitment of the members, rather.
And as Jack was alluding to, the sort of the ability of these narratives to take hold and just live on. Yeah. So our time is winding down. Final thought. What's the biggest takeaway here? What should we take away from the John Birch Society's influence, which seems to remain today? I mean, we've talked about a lot of it, but what's the biggest thought that you want to leave us with?
Well, I think I would just tell folks that the history that we have right now is incomplete. There are a number of great scholars at work, John Huntington, David Austin Walsh, Seth Kotler, who are rewriting the narrative of the conservative movement. They are research-based university professors, and they're doing great work. Rick Perlstein started this in a very important essay in which he wrote that, you know, 2016 convinced me that I was wrong about the conservative movement. And Rick Perlstein was the chronicler of four books on the conservative movement. Maybe he'll revisit those like a Lucasfilm.
Jack, in the 30 seconds that we have left, leave us with a final thought about all this.
Well, another quote from the satirical Chad Mitchell trio. Join the John Birch Society. Help us fill up the ranks. To get this movement started, we need lots of fools and cranks. There's no end of fools and cranks.
All right. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Thanks. It's always great to have you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Edward Miller, Associate Teaching Professor at Northeastern University. He's the author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, The John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. Ted Miller, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a great pleasure having you.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much.
And listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.